Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, February 26th, and I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria. This week, we're going to be chatting with an incredible science writer and physicist who wrote an amazing book. But before we dive in, I want to thank those of you who made Talk Nerdy possible. This week and every week ongoing, you know, Talk Nerdy is and will always be, I say it every week, 100% free to download. I mean it every week because it really does rely on support from listeners like you. If you want to support the show, the easiest by far way to do it is to visit patreon.com/talknerdy and pledge your episodic support. Big supporters this week include Phil T. Bear, David J. E. Smith, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Jeffrey Perez, Charles Payet, Jonathan Wright, Christian Jeffrey, The Honorable Husband, Jafe, Gabriel, Felipe, Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and of course, Jeffrey Sewell. Now, there are other ways to support the show. You can rate and review on iTunes. You can shop in the Talk Nerdy store. Just visit my website, carasantamaria.com, and you can find everything there. All right, guys, this is a good one. It's bittersweet because I finally got to reconnect with Lori Winkless. Now, you may have heard me bemoan the loss of my laptop on the show. This happened late last year after I did a kind of skeptical tour around Australia, New Zealand, and China. While I was there in New Zealand, in Wellington, actually, I had the incredible chance to sit down and podcast with a wonderful science writer named Lori Winkless. And she has a new book. It's called Science and the City, The Mechanics Behind the Metropolis. Unfortunately, that was the one recording on my desktop that never made it to the cloud, and I wasn't able to retrieve it. When my laptop was eaten by the bowels of American Airlines. So it's just gone. It's gone forever. It took me a little while to recover, but Lori is incredible. And she was willing to connect back with me remotely and redo that interview. Honestly, I think it might have been better the second time. Thank goodness. It was so much fun to be able to sit down and re-record with such a warm individual who is such a talented writer. I learned an awful lot. I know that you guys will too, and you'll probably love her accent as much as I do as well. So guys, without any further ado, it's the author of Science and the City, The Mechanics Behind the Metropolis, Lori Winkless. Well, Lori, thank you so much for joining me again.
My pleasure, Cara.
So for those who don't know, although I think most of you do, I visited Australia, New Zealand, and Hong Kong at the end of last year to speak at some of the skeptic societies around there. And soon after, I lost my laptop. And by lost, I mean I left it on a plane and knew exactly where it was, yet it still never made its way back to me. And Lori's episode was on the laptop and never made it to the cloud. And it was so depressing that it's taken me this long to reconnect and chat again. We got to record it in person in New Zealand where you live. What a bummer.
It was a very nice day, and it was nice to have the excuse to hang out with you, although I really wish that you hadn't. I can only imagine what it would feel like to lose your laptop. I'm attached to mine, so you have my sympathies.
No, oh, you're so sweet. Yes, I definitely went into mourning for a bit, but then I tried my best to remember that, you know, there are many worse things in the world and maintain perspective and all that. But in the moment, you're right. It is very tough. But I'm so excited to talk about your book. I have the paperback version of your book, but is this the like New Zealand version? Is it the US version? How did the publishing work on Science in the City?
So Science in the City was published initially in August 2016 in Europe. So it's Bloomsbury's the publisher. So they're kind of UK based. And it was a hardback edition. And then they kind of, for some reason, they always publish hardbacks first and then paperbacks come later. They call them mass market paperbacks, which I guess means they sell more. But yeah, so that came out just about 6 months ago or something. But so this is the same edition that will be in theory everywhere. So some regions will have a slightly different cover. But this one, the kind of orangey red paperback that you have, should be the kind of global edition, I guess, for want of a better word.
Is.
Although
okay.
there's also, yeah, there's a Korean edition and in Korean language, and there will be a Spanish edition in a few months as well, which is really exciting. So not just in English.
Oh my gosh, that's great. Not only does that point to the fact that like your book is doing really well and people want to read it in all these other languages, but it must be so cool to, even though you can't, I assume you can't read Korean, I could be wrong, but it must be so cool to see your book in Korean.
Yeah, I'm actually, it's sitting on the shelf beside me right now, and it's, the cover is so cool too, and you don't know anything about it until it arrives in the mail. So it was pretty exciting doing Google Translate via images to see how good the translation was.
Oh, that's so funny. Well, I mean, the cool thing about it, and I think part of the reason that it's doing so well and it's so readable, is that conceptually, topically, it's a book that is just so relevant and it so matters to everybody. I mean, you talk about what is happening in our global cities where more and more people are finding themselves living.
Yeah, exactly. So we kind of, a few years ago, reached this really interesting tipping point across the world where the majority of people became urbanites. So meaning that more people lived in towns and cities than lived in rural communities. And that's actually the first time that's ever happened. And that timing was, it was kind of lucky, if I'm honest, in the sense that I was already writing this book when the UN kind of released this statement about it. But it does point to the fact that cities are growing in importance, and not just for those of us who live in them, also for communities outside of cities that are in some cases being subsumed by cities. You know, they used to be separate towns, they're becoming suburbs as kind of urban sprawl happens in some areas. But it also, it comes with all these other challenges, like feeding people, like powering buildings, like getting transport, getting water, getting food to these incredibly dense areas. That comes with a whole other set of challenges, very different from looking after, say, a town. Once you start getting to the millions of people in a small area, everything gets a bit more complicated.
Oh, absolutely. You know, before I dive into all of the crazy things that we can talk about with regards to like just the necessities of infrastructure and sort of the impact, the environmental impact and things like that, I would love to talk about how you got into this, because this is your first book, but you've been writing for quite some time, but you're a physicist, aren't you?
Yes. Yeah. So my career has taken a very random series of leaps. But yeah, so I'm a physicist. I studied physics with astrophysics at Trinity College in Dublin. And then I went to do my master's, which was in space science. So actually back then I was really focused on a space career, but it was during my master's that I started to realize that I had a real interest in material science. And actually, with the benefit of hindsight, I probably always did, because my dad is an engineer, a toolmaker by trade, and we had always done very hands-on things together. So I loved breaking stuff, really, and learning how things worked. And that's really what material science is about. It has applications in every part of our life. So I had this incredible opportunity to join a research group at the National Physical Laboratory, which is the standards lab of the UK. So that's where the second is measured, and that's where the kilogram standard is kept and all of those things.
Oh, wow.
But alongside of that, they do really cool industrial research. I was lucky to get in as a baby scientist into the team there, and started to work as a material scientist and do research in that space. And that really, yeah, changed my life, I think, because it just changed the way that I viewed the world. And the lab itself is on the outskirts of London, which meant that I moved to this huge city to do my master's, and then I stayed on. And the two together, the combination of my kind of research in material science and understanding everything down to the bonds between atoms, and just living in a city as kind of epic as London and as connected as London, those two things kind of combined into this nugget of an idea that maybe I could write a book about how cities work. So people walking around their cities on a daily basis, you know, doing their commute or heading down to the shops to do their shopping, they might just look at a traffic light slightly differently after reading this book, or they might think about where the water goes when it runs down the drain, and maybe make them a bit more conscious, perhaps, about their choices. So I kind of had this nugget of an idea, and Yeah, kind of was contacted on Twitter. So never let it be said that time spent on Twitter is wasted time because I'd been blogging and writing about science kind of secretly for years. And I'd started getting some freelance, small freelance gigs that I was doing alongside my research and sharing them on Twitter. Caught the attention of a publisher at Bloomsbury who was starting to think about doing popular science books. And Bloomsbury are the guys who publish Harry Potter, right? So they're a big publisher.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ridiculous. I have the same publisher as J.K. Rowling. How ludicrous is that? if I had a tenth, probably a hundredth of her money, I'd be delighted. But anyway, yeah, so they, that this was a new thing for them. They hadn't done popular science before. And one of the publishers really wanted to find new voices. And he took to social media to start seeing the science communication community, really. And as you know, Cara, like, it's hugely active. There's lots of people talking about science and SciComm on Twitter. And yeah, he found me through there. And I had a few ideas and the city one won out and went through many hoops and many decision conferences and it was commissioned. So I fell into it, I think. I'm not sure I would have had the guts, if I'm honest, to approach a publisher myself. So the fact that he approached me and made me think, oh, maybe I could do this, was a huge thing for me.
Oh, I love it. I love hearing stories about kind of the serendipity of how a lot of people's careers took different paths. And a lot of times when young people ask me how I got into science communication or they ask for advice about science communication, I mean, the biggest piece I could ever give them is like, don't be afraid if a door opens, even if it's sort of jutting off to the left or the right of the straight path you've been going on. Because that's really, I think, what most people who have, I don't know, these really fulfilling careers, they'll tell me, oh, I got this super weird opportunity that I never would have gone out for on my own. And now this is what I do for a living.
Yeah.
So, you know, you mentioned that you went to school
in
London and it was sort of the first time that you lived in this really, really big city. And, you know, people listening, I said that we met in New Zealand. I don't know if I mentioned, but we were in Wellington and you live just outside of Wellington, right?
I do. Yes. Yeah, I live in a suburb of Wellington.
But you are not obviously from New Zealand. Most people might be able to recognize the Irish accent. Might be able to. My American listeners may not be able to discriminate. I'm not sure. But so did you grow up in a small town in Ireland?
Yeah, actually, the town I grew up in is called Dundalk. It's the biggest town in Ireland, but it's still a very small town by global standards. So yeah, I spent my whole childhood there. I lived in the same house my whole life. My parents still live there. Went to some great schools there. And yeah, it's about 50 miles north of Dublin. So when I headed to Dublin for university, didn't have to go very far. And basically, as soon as I finished my degree, I left to go to London to do my master's and moved to New Zealand about 18 months ago almost now. I can't really believe it. Time is flying.
Wow.
And yeah, I live in Wellington now. Love it. Love it over here.
Oh, love Wellington too. So tell me, maybe this is a good starting point, going from Ireland and then ending up in this huge city of London, what were some of the most kind of apparent changes to you? And, you know, did you fold those things into your book?
Yes, I love Wellington, as I said, but London will always be my favorite city, I think. It's just buzzing all the time. And that can be difficult some days. It can feel a bit stressful and a bit overwhelming. But yeah, coming from a small town and moving to this city, I've been to London lots of times as a visitor, but living there, I think the things you start to notice are how connected it is. So the tube, for example, the transport links are remarkable. You know, they really are. And they're so old. The beginnings of the tube is in the Victorian era. And in many ways, in fact, the development of the tube network, so this is the underground train network, the development of that is actually what shaped London. So the reason that London is the shape it is now is because of where tube stations were, which is a crazy concept. You know, we think of cities as you build a city and then as it gets busier, you increase the transport network. But London kind of took it the other way around and they used transport as a way to grow the city. And I loved that. I became kind of like, I loved that idea. And it requires a lot of forward thinking, right? A lot of ambitious thinking to think, I'm going to put a tube station in the middle of a field.
Yeah.
And people will come and they will want to live here. Which is like crazy when you think about it now. But that was the Victorian era. That's what they were like. And I loved that. You know, I loved that kind of ambition. And the fact that the engineering that goes into it is so remarkable. And it was so groundbreaking, literally, in the case of the tunnels, but also figuratively, it changed the way we viewed transport. So London is completely woven into Science and the City. It's in every single chapter. In fact, in some ways, it's kind of my love letter to London, because I'm also looking at it, London's past, and I look at London's present, and I look at kind of the near future for London and how it's changing. But I do that with other cities too. So I guess for me, when I started researching Science in the City, I thought that I would find this perfect city, you know, this one that all cities should aspire to be. I knew London probably wouldn't be it, just because there's plenty of things that don't work there either. But I thought I'd find one, and I didn't, actually. I didn't find one that makes me think, oh, well, actually, if we want to build a proper city, we should look to X. So I didn't really find that. I found examples in many cities. So that's really why it became a kind of a global book, because I wanted to find the best examples of certain things. And that meant I had to look everywhere. I couldn't just look to one place, which really broadened my horizons too. You know, it really gave me an opportunity to see cities differently and to try to see cities through the eyes of people who live in them, mm-hmm. because they're not all the same. They share many of the same challenges, but they're not always in the same order of priority, if you know what I mean. So yeah, I loved having a perfectly valid excuse to do that research, you know, and to talk to as many people in places across the world as I could.
Did you travel a lot, or did you just do a lot of remote interviews with people?
Yeah, little bits and pieces of travel, but mostly mm-hmm. remote, I have to say. And that's probably why partly there's a lot of London in it, because I was there. So mm-hmm. I could just go and chat to people. I could just go, oh, I want to talk to you about, you know, your new tunnel. And mm-hmm. they would invariably say, okay, sure, come down and visit. So a lot of it was that. But yeah, I talked to people. I think I feature cities on all of the continents that have cities in them.
Oh, so, that's so neat.
It's got quite a spread. Yeah.
So I'm wondering if part of the reason that you sort of had to cobble together the most interesting, the most innovative, the best of each city is partially because obviously different cities have different requirements. You know, if a city is low-lying like Amsterdam, it's going to need different kinds of drainage, yeah. kinds of protocols than a city that's in the desert or close mm-hmm. to the desert like Los Angeles. But then also, cities are iterative, aren't they? Like, most cities aren't lucky enough to have been yeah. planned for the booming population they have from the beginning.
No, for sure. And I think this is another thing that is quite interesting at this period in history, mm-hmm. because there are now efforts to build cities from scratch and make them perfect. Now, how successful they have been is very much under debate. Many of these kind of planned cities feel artificial because they kind of are in some ways. Mm-hmm. Yeah, most cities are built on the ghosts of previous cities, you know. So like London, you think about the Victorian infrastructure, it's still carrying millions of people a day, but there are more modern bits to the infrastructure too. And that has to work with the kind of historical infrastructure. So yeah, most cities are having to not only kind of look forward, but also maintain the past, because it's not possible to rip out all of the water system that's been in place in Chicago for 100 years and just replace it. You are normally trying to just make it last a bit longer, try and keep it maintained as long as possible. It's really difficult to bulldoze a city and start again. And do we want to do that? Oh, I'm not sure. The engineer, the scientist in me says that would be the easiest way to get an optimal city. But a city is not just a collection of buildings. It's not just its infrastructure. It's also the atmosphere. It's also the trees that have been planted in the parks for 70 years. And it's the people who live in it. So I think we should celebrate the historical cities and try our very best to maintain the infrastructure that we can't replace. Mm-hmm. But also we need to be much braver in our decisions about what we're going to do for the future. So we can make iterative changes going forward from now, but our populations are growing beyond our ambitions, if you know what I mean. So we have to think about our water infrastructure. Every city has to deal with a water shortage now. Every city near the coast has to think about climate change. Every city has to think about how we can ensure that the people living in cities have the best quality of life while also fitting many more people into that same space. And they are very big questions that don't have a single simple answer. And that's the biggest thing of all, really, I think. If we want our cities to get better, we don't want our cities to degrade. You know, we don't want them to be like, oh, do you remember when New York was really great to live in and it just gets worse and worse? We don't want that. Mm-hmm. We want our future, our kids and our grandkids and future generations to thrive in those cities, because the cities aren't going anywhere. But we have to make sure that what we're building is a city that is better for the people that live in it. Oh. And better for our environment.
Yeah, there's so many things I want to talk to you about. I have to like take notes so that I can remember all the questions I want to ask. I'm like literally feverishly writing China, New York versus Paris, LA. Okay, so starting with China, you mentioned this idea, or we were starting to talk about this idea of sort of cities being engineered from scratch and then built for the population. And that same trip, and actually weirdly, we didn't get to talk about this the first time we recorded this episode, which is now lost to the ether, because I hadn't yet gone to China. That was my next stop after Wellington, was Hong Kong, and then up into Dongguan. Well, I spent a little bit of time in Dongguan, which is in Guangdong, and it's a manufacturing community in southern China. And it's like bananas, population exploding. Like there are cities that didn't exist 20 years ago, and now there's like 9 million people that live in them. It's just, it's bizarre. Yeah. And there's cranes everywhere and like apartment buildings going up left and right. And yeah, there's some questions about regulations and permits and, you know, security and things like that. But but this question of kind of building a city because they know that there's just going to be so many damn people and they need there to be infrastructure is a fascinating one to me, because will these cities work? Like, how do you know it'll work until people have been in it for a while and things are like tried and true?
Yeah, you don't really. Like, to be honest, you don't. And the benefit that a lot of those, well, the advantage, I should say, that a lot of those city developers have is that they can look to other cities and see what has worked well for them. You know, so they can think about building a sewer system that can cope with beyond even their wildest dreams in terms of population. Because again, like looking back at London in Victorian times, the sewer system was built very ambitiously with this idea that London's population, you know, might reach, I can't remember what the number was, but like 5 million people. Oh my goodness. And it's gone way beyond, you know, that at the time that number seemed ridiculous, but it's gone way beyond that. So these new cities, they can look to the older cities to see the things that have been problems for them. And in theory, at least, learn from them and build, you know, future-proof infrastructure. But it is really hard. Mm-hmm. It's really hard. And then the idea of building a city that people want to live in, well, that's a whole other question. You know, that's not quite the same as building a city that is functional. And yes, maybe sometimes people would argue that European cities have a bit of a head start on that. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a slightly different approach to city life in Europe. Cities tend to be much more walkable. You can get around on foot quite a lot, or you can use local buses or trams or whatever. You can get around on free bicycles. There, that's a kind of a very European view of what a city should be. But yeah, in these massive Chinese cities, which are focused often on employment, so focused around an area of manufacturing or something else that they know will pull people in, they are kind of they're building really, really quickly, but there's plenty of argument to say that they're not actually thinking about what the city will be like to live in 50 years, like as a city, as a functioning, living, breathing organism that a city tends to turn into.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's lots of questions about like what type of city is the best city. But yeah, I don't think there's a simple answer.
So even in that kind of response, you mentioned this idea of sort of the European model of the city. And me, as an American who was born and raised here, and I've lived in quite big cities. I grew up in the suburb of Dallas, then I lived in New York, and now I live in Los Angeles, which are, you know, some of the bigger cities in the country. Yeah. It's still very different when I visit Paris or London or Amsterdam or, you know, these larger cities in Europe, because there's an aesthetic difference to them. Not that I'm denigrating my American cities because I love them, but they're just, they're not old. Like you mentioned, like our cities in America are only 250 years old, maybe a little more than that, depending on where you are. And you go to these places in Europe where there are like freaking castles everywhere. And there are literally some kind of historical maintained buildings from the Middle Ages. It's incredible to see.
Yes.
And so there must be something about, you know, finding that balance between modern and new and clean and antiseptic and functional and efficient, but also old and aesthetic, right? Just something about aesthetics, it really is good for us psychologically.
Oh, totally, totally. And there's been lots of, now this is kind of outside of my expertise, but there's been lots of research that's looked into the kind of well-being of people living in cities, and the things that they talk about is the things they like in cities. And a lot of the time it's really small things, you know, it's having park benches to sit on. It's having, instead of a really functional bus stop, like having a tree beside the bus stop that makes it a bit less like a bus stop, or, you know, the idea that they can cross over a canal or a stream to get to work. So it's all of those, they're all very small things, but it's possible to plan them into a city. It's not to say that new cities have to just be functional. It is possible to plan them in, but it can sometimes be difficult to identify that kind of X factor, that thing about European cities that I think you're right. I think a lot of it comes from the fact that when you walk around a city like Paris, you're actually seeing, you know, many generations of work done by Parisians to change and beautify their city. So you're seeing, or in London too, you're seeing buildings that are older than entire areas of the country, like, well, than cities in New Zealand for sure, because New Zealand's even younger in terms of urban growth. But yeah, so there is something about that, I think. And I think that's why the kind of European style of city tends to be popular with the people who live in them, but they are also very challenging to manage in terms of things like services. So like delivering electricity and internet access and water and getting waste away, narrow streets, cobbled footpaths, they're all really difficult to manage around. So it's a constant battle between form and function.
Absolutely. I mean, it makes sense, right? Like when you really step back and you think about it, it makes sense that the older and less sort of planned the cities are for these more modern conveniences, the more they have to sort of be retrofit and like rigged in.
Oh, yeah.
I'm really reminded of the time that I spent in Venice, where the city is literally sinking. And not just that, like, and it floods whenever it's the rainy season, but it also, like, as beautiful as Venice is, there's this funny thing that you don't get from pictures, which is that in certain canals, in certain times of year, the city literally smells like shit. And I don't think that people always know. And it's because historically their sewage system was non-existent. They literally dumped the sewage into the water.
Yeah.
And it's just, it used to work when there weren't that many people and we didn't know about diseases.
Yeah, exactly. And you even think about, like, you know, more modern cities that are absolutely booming. They still have an issue with waste. You know, they still have that question of, how do we keep shit away from humans?
Yeah.
Like, that is a huge problem. And as our cities are getting denser and our sewage systems are struggling, you know, ever more struggling, and of course we're starting to see in many parts of the world increase in rainfall, that all feeds into the same system in most cities. So they don't have separate flood drains to sewers. So when you have a lot of rain and you have a growing population, you're much more likely to get floods. You're much more likely to see literal, you know, raw sewage on the roads. And nobody wants that. You know, nobody wants that. That's going to make people sick. But in many developing nations, that is the reality that they're living with every single day. So every day, the water that they have access to is dangerous. For us here, spoiled in the Western world, we turn on our tap, and in most cities, the water that comes out of your tap is clean enough for you to drink safely. Mm-hmm. We mostly use it to wash our dishes and wash our laundry. It doesn't need to be that clean for those purposes. So we're being delivered this ridiculously high quality water that only a tiny portion of it is actually needs to be as clean as it is. And the rest of that deliciously clean water, we're using it to dirty things. We're using it on dirty things, you know? So, and then in other cities, you have people who are having to drink water, having to treat water themselves that is much more dangerous than the water that's come out of our laundry machines. You know, it's ridiculous, really, when we think about it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the water in our toilet bowls, I mean, it's not clean because we use our toilets, but if we have a freshly cleaned toilet, that is, you know, ostensibly the same water that, for all intents and purposes, that comes out of our tap. It becomes, what's it called? I know gray water is the water that we wash with, or after we've washed, what it becomes. Yes. Is this called brown water? Yeah. Is toilet water brown water? Black water?
They still count it as gray water.
Do. Okay.
Because it'll often have bleach in it.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah. Gotcha.
Yeah. But black water, once it has any contact with feces, it's called black water. Yes. Then you just don't want to get near that stuff. That's bad. But we are seeing cities that are separating those things out. So they're using technology and pretty simple plumbing, to be honest, to separate it out so that you have a drinking water supply, but the water that is used to run, I don't know, if you have a dishwasher or, you know, a washing machine or whatever in your house, they run on grey water that is lightly treated. So it would not be clean enough to drink, but it's more than clean enough to flush your toilets with. And in some cities, we're starting to see buildings that can actually take black water from the sewers, treat it to the point at which it becomes grey water, and then they're using that as toilet water in the building so that none of the water supply from the sewer, you know, the actual water supply is being used in flushing toilets. It's just the water that is dirty but still clean enough is being used. It's being like removed from the sewers, treated locally and used locally. So that idea, I think, is very cool. You know, the idea that we can locally treat our water for the function it needs to have rather than making everything drinking quality, because that's expensive, takes a lot of time, and it's very wasteful.
Oh, it's a genius idea. It's just, it's one of those functions of retroactively having, because we just didn't think about it before. In LA, it's nice to see we're dealing with drought. You know, that's a very common problem out here. And it's nice to see that when they do water plants, which is rare, a lot of times we just don't water grass anymore. But when they do, you'll see little signs and buildings and municipal kind of areas that'll say, this water is not potable water, you know, don't drink it. This is water that is like gray water that we're just using to water the plants. And I'm like, yay, go LA. That's good to see.
Yeah, that's cool.
All right, guys, I want to take a quick break to thank the sponsors of this week's episode of Talk Nerdy, starting with a new sponsor, Casper. Yay! How exciting, guys. Casper is a sleep brand that makes expertly designed products to help you get your best rest one night at a time. And of course, I'm talking about super comfortable, super affordable mattresses that are designed to mimic human curves, providing supportive comfort for all kinds of bodies. Maybe not just human bodies. Maybe if there's some dog bodies and cat bodies sleeping in a bed, I think they'll feel pretty comfortable and supported too. The original Casper mattress combines multiple supportive memory foams for a quality sleep surface with the right amounts of both sink and bounce. But of course, there are two other mattresses, the Wave and the Essential. What I love about Casper mattresses is that they're breathable. They help you sleep cool. I need that so much. Regulate your body temperature. They're highly rated and reviewed on Amazon, on Casper.com, on Google. And ooh, this one's really cool too. Not only are they affordable and they have hassle-free returns if you're not completely satisfied, they're delivered right to your door. They completely cut out the middleman. They come right to you in like this box that is too small for a mattress, but somehow it fits inside. You also get free shipping and returns if you're in the US and Canada. And guys, you can be sure of your purchase with Casper's 100-night risk-free sleep on it trial. So what are you waiting for? You can get $50 towards select mattresses by visiting casper.com/nerdy and using promo code nerdy at checkout. Terms and conditions apply. Again, that's $50 towards select mattresses, because you are a Talk Nerdy listener if you visit casper.com/nerdy and use the promo code nerdy. I also want to thank Blue Apron for their support of this show. Blue Apron, as you know, is a leading meal kit delivery service in the U.S. And while a lot of people already know what Blue Apron does, you might not know about the kinds of food that you can cook when you use Blue Apron. You're not just having burgers, you're having short rib burgers with a hoppy cheddar sauce on a pretzel bun. Yum! Or you're making seared steaks and thyme pan sauce with mashed potatoes, green beans, and crispy shallots, and you're doing it in under 45 minutes and without a trip to the grocery store, because the way that Blue Apron works is you will get everything you need in one box. You can get the two-person meal plan with 8 new recipes per week to choose from, with the choice to receive either 2 or 3 a week. You can get the family meal plan where you're serving 4 people and you're choosing from 4 new recipes per week with the choice to receive 2, 3, or 4. Ooh, or you can get the wine plan, 6 bottles of wine from renowned winemakers delivered monthly. So much going on. Okay, guys, I love it. I get it all the time. It tastes super good. It's really easy to do. I am not a good cook, and I make cool new things all the time with Blue Apron that I never, ever would have been able to make on my own. I just wouldn't know how to do it. All right, guys. So as usual, this is very important. You are very special as a Talk Nerdy listener, and Blue Apron is treating you to $30 off your first order if you visit blueapron.com/nerdy. So check out this week's menu, get $30 off at blueapron.com/nerdy. All right, guys, let's get back to the show. Okay, so speaking of water and speaking of toilets and drains, one of the things that was so fascinating to me that we talked about the first time we got to chat, and I've seen it in the news since then, are these, what are they called, fatbergs?
Oh, my favorite. Yeah, I loved it.
I was like, I would be so mad at myself if we didn't get to fatberg. So right here in the middle of the episode, it's fatberg time. I love this and hate this and find it so disgusting and so fascinating at the same time.
Yeah, it's exactly. That's, you described my emotions about them too. Yeah.
Okay, so what's a fatberg for people who don't know?
Okay. So just picture the scene. Every time you clean off your frying pan, you know, you've got some oil or some fat down there, it goes down the drain, you don't have to worry about it. However, when it hits the drains, it will get into cold water. And as I'm sure the listeners to your podcast know, oil and water don't mix. So what ends up happening is you get this lovely, oily, greasy layer from all the houses and all the restaurants around. And I should say that most restaurants are supposed to have grease traps that capture most of this, but many don't have this, which is a big problem. So you get all this oil and grease from cooking going down the drain. You also get things that people flush down the toilets, like baby wipes, condoms, cotton swabs, things like that.
Yeah, I don't think you're supposed to
flush down the toilet. Definitely not. I should say that when something is described as flushable, that does not mean it is biodegradable. Okay, it just means that it will fit through the U-bend in your toilet. So if you have wipes in your house that say flushable, check that they are also biodegradable before you put them into the toilet, because once it goes into the toilet, it goes into the drain, and when it meets a layer of fat, it sticks to it. So over time, you get these globules of fat and these baby wipes and cotton swabs and everything else that gets into a city's drain, and they amalgamate into a mass, which has been called a fatberg. So kind of iceberg, but made of fat and grease. And these things can just grow to ridiculous proportions. I'm talking about like the size of double-decker buses. They will fill a drain.
Wait, okay, yeah, so just so like, I understand, are drains that big in the city? Like, how big is a water pipe underneath our feet?
So a lot of them are pretty small. You know, they would just be like less than a meter in diameter for sure. But once you start getting to the main water supply, often they can be in some places like 10 meters wide.
Whoa.
Huge. You could drive a car through
them. Amazing.
They're enormous. Yeah. So it depends on the city. It depends on which bit of the water cycle you're in, really. But yeah, you can get even bigger. I can't remember what the biggest sewer is that I found, but it's enormous.
Wow.
But yeah, these things will grow because they take a long time. You can imagine it's a lot of people's stuff that have to mash together to form a fatberg, but they can grow to the point at which they break the drains effectively. So in the news in the last year, we've had so many of these fatbergs that have literally cracked water pipes and caused flooding onto the street. And they get so hard that they have to be jackhammered apart. Like these are, it feels like I've had the pleasure maybe of holding a piece of fatberg in my hand, in my gloved hand, I should say. But it's solid. It feels like a building material, genuinely. Like it's a solid, heavy material. And they have to go at it with pickaxes and jackhammers and drills just to break it apart to get it out of the sewer.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's a complete result of our idea that there's this magical away that we can throw things in. You know, people go, oh, I just threw it away. It's like, where is this away that you imagine exists? Every time you flush the toilet or you throw something down the sink, it goes into the drains. That's where it goes. And eventually it'll have to be removed either through water treatment or in the case of a fatberg through jackhammer. But yeah, so I think it's a lot of it is because people either don't think or don't know, or maybe, I don't know, don't care about the fact that they put stuff down their drains. I just think that there's some magic that looks after it. But that's kind of, again, that was part of the motivation for writing the book, was actually have a think about this stuff. Like, think about it. And when you stop and think about it, you might find your behavior changes. People, I've had a lot of friends who now have a can on their kitchen countertop that they fill with their fat, their cooking fat, which is pretty gross, but it's very responsible of them. And they're thinking differently about their relationship with water and waste.
Oh, absolutely. It's not that difficult to be mindful of those things. But I think sometimes the reason we aren't mindful of it is because we just don't know. I'm glad that you mentioned that this was a big motivating factor of your book, because I think for me personally, it's the biggest takeaway was what you literally just said that I think bears repeating, absolute repeating. There is no away. Like things go somewhere. They don't just vanish. And we know that when we're talking about things we flush down the toilet, things we wash down the drain, things we throw in the trash or the bin or the rubbish or the garbage, whatever you want to call it. We know that with regards to plastics that don't biodegrade, that end up in the ocean. Like we have to think about the journey of these quote unquote disposable, discardable, single use things in our lives, because even though they might be single use to us, it's very rare, like only a small percentage of the things we actually use, like you said, fully biodegrade.
Yeah, we absolutely have a responsibility to do that. And it can be really small steps. And I'm not going to preach at anyone. And I hope that the book doesn't feel preachy in that sense. But actually, it's very easy to make very small changes that feel very small to you, but actually in the time, kind of your lifetime, if you continue that for the rest of your life, you'll have an impact. Might feel like a small one, but it will be significant. There's also lots of responsibility on producers of these materials. Like my own personal belief is if the people who produce the plastic film that goes on like ready meals or inexplicably on fruit packets, if the companies who made that film were also responsible for it at the end of life, they would find a way to produce a biodegradable film.
Yeah, for sure.
Because if they had a financial, you know, penalty for it making its way to a dump, they would find a better way to do it. So there's definitely a responsibility from us to stop thinking about, and this is very true in cities, because I think people who live in rural areas tend to have a different approach to the use, reuse, recycle type thing, just because often they don't have access to new things all the time, just because of distance. But in cities, we can just go, oh yeah, well, I'll get that takeaway cup and I'll just chuck it in the bin and I'll get this and I'll get that. And everything's very close at hand for a lot of people. So it's easy to just, it's tempting, I guess, to think about your takeaway containers. But actually, it's very easy if you do the same grocery shop every week to just bring your Tupperware box with you and get the butcher to put your meat in there, or to bring your own paper bags or canvas bags and put your vegetables in there. And they're such tiny changes. If enough of us do them, it will change the way that we think about our waste. And we have to think about our waste. Our population is far too big now to not be thinking about it anymore.
And it's true. Kind of I think the richer we are, sometimes the more that we have access to, especially living in these kind of very developed places like America, like New Zealand, like the UK, we don't always think about the percentage, sort of the ratio of like person to waste that we really are throwing out. If you think about trash day and how full is bin when you take it to the curb, if you're lucky enough to have trash collection once a week, like, you know, what's the ratio between your trash and your recycling? Are you using recycling? And you mentioned if you live in a rural area that maybe you don't have as much access to single-use things and you use things more often. But also, you know, if you have a septic tank that you have to take care of instead of using a municipal waste system, or if you, you know, don't have a recycling center that picks up your recycling and you have to physically like take any waste away from your home, otherwise you're just living with it, you're going to be much more mindful about the things you buy.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that's true for foods as well. I think in our cities, and I've definitely noticed a difference between, this is like such a small thing, but like from living in London, I could buy like capsicum, I could buy strawberries, raspberries any day of the week in any supermarket. Zero problems. Really cheap and, you know, really good fruit and vegetables. And in New Zealand, I think because of our kind of isolation or relative isolation, food is much more seasonal here. So, you know, you probably won't see raspberries beyond a couple of months of the year, and they're really expensive when they have them. And I think in cities as well, because we can have access to lots of things, it's kind of understandable that we would, in some ways, that we would buy lots of things. But yeah, if those things are having a really negative impact on the environment, then, you know, it is up to us to make those decisions and to put pressure on the people who can make bigger changes, like manufacturers. So yes, we do our part, but if we really firmly believe that we should have a better relationship with plastic wrap, for example, then we need to get out there and argue, and we need to stop buying the products that use them. Because very quickly, once the dollar sign is in doubt, companies will change their behavior. So I think that within cities, we have buying power, but we also have kind of protest power about this kind of stuff too. And we need to use it more.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, we've been talking about water a bit, and there's so many more things to talk about, but I want to just hit on one more point about water that has also been in the news a lot lately. You know, we're talking sort of about waste and things that we flush away. But of course, this idea that we have access to clean, drinkable, healthy, safe water that doesn't have pathogens, but also just that we have access to water at all. Like, if I've been following the news, not as closely as I would like to, but about the water shortage in Cape Town, and it's just devastating. And this is what most people would consider to be, you know, like a developed city where people were used to the comforts that many of us have in the kinds of places where we live. And and the fact that, like, what are they going to do now? They're running out of water.
Yeah, they really are. And then you have questions about water becoming like a commodity. And nobody really wants that to happen either, you know, because then it's essential to life. And you have cities like Doha and Dubai and things that are in the desert, and by their very nature, they are constantly dealing with drought conditions. But they've taken the very expensive approach of desalinating seawater, so removing the salt from seawater, which is extremely energy intensive, extremely expensive to do. But they see that as their only option. Most cities have a backup for that to have, you know, so they can do that if they need to. But some cities in hotter climates, and we're going to see a change, and many more cities will have that issue, they think it's worth the money to do that because they don't have
We're going to have to start doing
choice.
That in LA for sure.
And a lot of, for yeah, sure. Oh, for sure. Yeah. And I think we are starting to see, like, I interviewed quite a few people who are looking at smarter ways to do that. So using lower energy methods, using membranes that have particular types of holes and particular types of materials that allow water to flow through without huge electricity pumps. there's a real research focus on that too, because it's desperate, you know, where it's desperate times for many cities in terms of access to water. And yeah, when you're starting to ship, having to ship water in, you know, you have a problem. And with our changing climate, that's going to become more common, unfortunately.
Oh, absolutely. So we've talked, obviously, we've barely scratched the surface, but we've talked a bit about transit. We've talked a bit about water. What have we not talked about yet? We haven't really talked much about infrastructure like bridges and roads. We haven't really talked much about other utilities like electricity, like internet, cable, access to these kinds of things. What kinds of, interesting things did you discover when you were learning about these different aspects of the city?
I think with electricity in particular, I guess like most people, I hadn't really ever thought beyond that little white box in my wall, you know, like I knew the physics of it. I knew how we could produce electricity and stuff, but I hadn't really thought about the infrastructure behind that plug, behind that plug socket. So it was quite interesting to take that journey back, you know, to go back from the power socket back to the energy generation plant. And what surprised me, I guess, was how different everyone's kind of electricity landscape is, you know, like so many cities are using mostly renewable energy now. That's not even like weird anymore. That's such as completely normal. Like a lot of Scandinavian, a lot of the kind of Nordic countries, they're using renewable energy for the vast majority of their electricity needs. That's true in New Zealand too. So hydropower is a huge thing here in New Zealand. So a huge part of our energy down here comes from wind power and hydropower. And that, I guess, surprised me because I didn't realize how far along some cities were in that transition.
Yeah, because American popular culture dominates the media landscape and we are so ass backward here. I'm so jealous to hear that. And then there are cities that are doing great things here in the States, but we are still so reliant on fossil fuels.
And that kind of leads into the electric cars thing a bit as well, because that was kind of, that ended up being where I ended up going, which is electric cars are fantastic when you have an electricity grid that is green. If you have a car that needs to be plugged in, which, you know, some don't, but if you have one that needs to be plugged in, what is it actually being plugged into? If it's being plugged into a coal-powered electricity grid, it's probably not much better for the environment than a fossil fuel car. Probably not.
Exactly. Yeah, like you're not putting out emissions, but you're right. It's like, this is, again, a theme that I see over and over when I read your book. It's like, everything is connected. You know what I mean? Like none of these things are siloed. And so I drive electric here in LA, and granted, LA is slightly greener than some other cities, but
much greener,
our goal with our home is to get the Tesla roof tiles and to get the power wall so that we have a backup battery and completely get off the grid. Like, I don't want to be reliant on the city's electricity. I live in like the sunniest place. Like, why am I not taking energy from the sun and driving my car with it?
Well, quite. Yeah, I think especially like on in California, the western coast of the US. I mean, it was amazing when I was there a year and a half ago to see all the wind farms. It was incredible for me. I loved it. So I think definitely there are huge parts of the US that are really, really investing heavily in renewable energy. But yeah, if I had as much sun as LA, I would definitely be tapping into it.
it's still kind of expensive for a lot of people. But yeah, I think a lot of that is like almost more political than it is actually economic or feasible for other reasons, because there's a weird like coal culture that's become a sort of tribalistic dividing line here that I don't understand because it just doesn't really exist in Europe. But I hope that we can get on the other side of that historically.
Yeah, I think so. And I honestly think that cities are taking, especially in the US, are leading the way on that stuff. Just saying, yeah, government can have their policy, but us as a city, us as a state, us as an area, we're going to invest in this stuff. And it's heartening actually to see it.
Absolutely. All right. So you have a physics background, and of course it was with a focus in astronomy, but you're definitely interested in the engineering and the mechanics of these things. Like, what are the things that make you drool? Is it bridges? Do you love bridges? Do you love insane freeway structures? Like, when you go into a glistening, kind of efficient, very modern city, what is it that makes you go like, ooh, pretty? How does that work?
I'm going to be honest. I freaking love tunnels. It's weird. Yeah, I love them. Like, I didn't know how much I love tunnels. I did no idea until I started writing this
book. Because it like, does it just blow your mind that the mountain doesn't fall in on itself when you drill a tunnel through? I mean, I never really understood how they worked, honestly.
Well, it's all about circles, right? Circles have this perfect geometry, so they don't have to, like, they spread out the load across the whole shape of the circle. So I just love, I love this idea that we kind of tunnel through history. You know, we dig through the ground to create new infrastructure. And I also love the machines that are used to do them, to build these tunnels, these tunnel boring machines. I just think that they're this epic, epic engineering. And most people are completely oblivious to the fact that this technology even exists. They're like, oh yeah, it's just a tunnel. Like, do you know how hard it is to build a tunnel? Do you know? So yeah, I've become like totally obsessed. Like I went down in London, there's a new train network called Crossrail that's being built. And the guys who run that just basically adopted me because I just wouldn't leave them alone. just kept asking questions. And I spent a lot of time down those tunnels looking at how they're constructed and look at, and also meeting the archaeologists who work alongside these tunnel engineers to make sure that when they are digging the tunnel, they're not destroying history. And I loved that idea. I loved that idea that a city is a really layered structure, you know, physically, figuratively layered structure. And I love that tunnels are this incredibly elegant solution that not only let us get around our cities more, but just have so much cool physics and maths in it, you know? Just, yeah, it's weird, I know, but I love them.
No, it's not only do I not think it's weird, I bet you and Elon Musk would get along really well, because doesn't he have a new company called The Boring Company?
He does.
And it's all about boring?
Yeah, they're trying to reinvent tunnel boring machine. I have very mixed feelings on Elon Musk, I should say, but I'm keeping an eye on The Boring Company for sure.
I love it. Oh, it's so great. Well, Lori, okay, we've been chatting for about an hour, almost an hour, which is so crazy. And I've been having so much fun talking to you. I feel so terrible that we're having to do this remotely, but I guess second time's a charm. At the end of all of my episodes, I always ask my guests the same two questions. I have no idea if you remember your answers from the first time, but that's okay. Come up with new ones. Are you ready for our final two questions, madam?
I am ready. I'm ready.
All right. So the first one is, when you think about the future, and of course, you've done that quite a bit with the research that you've done for this book, in whatever context is relevant, whether it has to do with cities or it has to do with bigger picture questions that have been on your mind recently. Number one, what is the thing that you are most concerned about, most worried about? Like, what kind of keeps you up most at night? And then on the flip side of that, what are you most optimistic and really hopeful for?
I think the thing I'm most concerned about is the kind of ongoing debate, and you can't see this, but I'm doing air quotes around debate around climate change. So I think that I'm so concerned that we are not taking, I was going to say the threat of climate change, but it's beyond a threat now. The reality of climate change seriously enough. We are kind of taking the smallest possible steps, which were the steps we needed to take 25 years ago. Now we need to be taking enormous paradigm shifting leaps in order to minimize the impact of this on us and on our children and on their children's futures. And I'm just really worried that as a society, I know it's not the world is not one society, although I wish it was, but in the sense that it was a unified voice. But I think as a society, we're not taking that threat seriously enough. And it really worries me that we've passed the point that we can preserve what we have. So that's the thing that worries me and keeps me awake at night. The thing that inspires me and makes me feel positive for the future are young people. In the last few days, especially, I think that we've seen some remarkable leadership being shown from people who are teenagers. And I think that in many cases, they show us adults up to be very cowardly in our actions and in our decisions. And also, they are so passionate about STEM and science. And I've gone to so many like youth science fairs and I've met young researchers and interviewed lots of PhD students right at the starts of their research careers. And they are so passionate and so ready to take control and to make a difference and to make a change and completely unapologetic about that. And that gives me great comfort. And I saw an amazing tweet about it yesterday, which was, you know, we've raised our teenagers on a diet of dystopian novels and movies. Did we think that was fiction? No, it was preparation. And I love that. I just thought it was like the best tweet ever, because I do feel like our young people are so empowered to make differences, make a change. And they're so educated and so smart and engaged and interested. And they give me great comfort for the future.
Ugh. I love that. And I love ending on that hopeful note, because I think that sometimes we do get quite caught up and we do start to despair because we're old. And sometimes we stop and we think about how what kind of the state that we've put things in and the state that our parents and our grandparents have put things in. And we forget that, like, we're not the end of it. And like, there are just so many people who are so innovative and who are just solving so many new problems in a way that we've gotten to be stuck in our ways. You know, that creativity gets drained out the longer that you are constrained.
Yeah.
And it's so cool. It's so cool to see these really innovative and creative solutions to these massive global problems that are really out there. So
absolutely.
Thank you so much, Lori.
A pleasure.
It means a lot to me that you were willing to do this twice, first of all. And
no
I know
problem.
It means a lot to the listeners and for, you know, dialing in with me from literally, I don't want to say halfway around the world. It's like more than halfway around the world. We couldn't be farther apart.
I'm a huge Talk Nerdy fan, so it's been a great pleasure.
Oh, that means a lot to me. Guys, the book is Science and the City, The Mechanics Behind the Metropolis. You can buy it anywhere books are sold. And my dog is barking to say goodbye. I'm going to link out to it in the show notes so that you can just click, put it in your Amazon cart and go. Lori, once again, thank you for joining me. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.